who could not have been happier, but mostly the world existed under an oppressive, dusky pall. It was this deathly dimness that inspired the Byron lines above. Spring never came, and summer never warmed. 1816 became known as the year without summer. Crops everywhere failed to grow. In Ireland, a famine and associated typhoid epidemic killed 65,000 people. In New England, the year became popularly known as 1800 and froze to death. Morning frosts continued until June, and almost no planted seed would grow. Short of fodder, livestock died or had to be prematurely slaughtered. In every way it was a dreadful year, almost certainly the worst for farmers in modern times. Yet globally, the temperature fell by only about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Earth's natural thermostat, as scientists would learn, is an exceedingly delicate instrument. The 19th century was already a chilly time. For 200 years, Europe, and North America in particular, had experienced a little ice age, as it has become known, which permitted all kinds of wintry events, frost fairs on the Thames, ice skating races along Dutch canals, that are mostly impossible now. It was a period, in other words, when frigidity was much on people's minds. So we may perhaps excuse 19th-century geologists for being slow to realize that the world they lived in was in fact balmy compared with former epochs, and that much of the land around them had been shaped by crushing glaciers and cold that would wreck even a frost fair. They knew there was something odd about the past. The European landscape was littered with inexplicable anomalies. The bones of Arctic reindeer in the warm south of France, huge rocks stranded in improbable places. And they often came up with inventive but not terribly plausible explanations. One French naturalist named De Luc, trying to explain how granite boulders had come to rest high up on the limestone flanks of the Jura Mountains, suggested that perhaps they had been shot there by compressed air in caverns, like corks out of a pop gun. The term for a displaced boulder is an erratic, but in the 19th century the expression seemed to apply more often to the theories than to the rocks. The great British geologist Arthur Hallam has suggested that if James Hutton, the father of geology, had visited Switzerland, he would have seen at once the significance of the carved valleys, the polished striations, the telltale strand lines where rocks had been dumped, and the other abundant clues that point to passing ice sheets. Unfortunately, Hutton was not a traveller. But even with nothing better at his disposal than second-hand accounts, Hutton rejected out of hand the idea that huge boulders had been carried 3,000 feet up mountainsides by floods. All the water in the world won't make a boulder float, he pointed out, and became one of the first to argue for widespread glaciation. Unfortunately, his ideas escaped notice, and for another half century most naturalists continued to insist that the gouges on rocks could be attributed to passing carts, or even the scrape of hobnailed boots. Local peasants, uncontaminated by scientific orthodoxy, knew better, however. The naturalist, Jean de Charpentier, told the story of how, in 1834, he was walking along a country lane with a Swiss woodcutter when they got to talking about the rocks along the roadside. The woodcutter matter-of-factly told him that the boulders had come from the Grimsel, a zone of granite some distance away. When I asked him how he thought that these stones had reached their location, he answered without hesitation, "The Grimsel Glacier transported them on both sides of the valley, because that glacier extended in the past as far as the town of Bern." Charpentier was delighted. He had come to such a view himself, but when he raised the notion at scientific gatherings, it was dismissed. One of Charpentier's closest friends was another Swiss naturalist, Louis Agassiz, who after some initial scepticism came to embrace and eventually all but appropriate the theory. Agassiz had studied under Cuvier in Paris, and now held the post of Professor of Natural History at the College of Neuchâtel in Switzerland. Another friend of Agassiz, a botanist named Carl Schimper, was actually the first to coin the term Ice Age, in German Eiszeit, in 1837, and to propose that there was good evidence to show that ice had once lain heavily across not just the Swiss Alps, but over much of Europe, Asia, and North America. It was a radical notion. He lent Agassiz his notes, then came very much to regret it, as Agassiz increasingly got the credit for what Schimper felt, with some legitimacy, was his theory. Charpentier likewise ended up a bitter enemy of his old friend. Alexander von Humboldt, yet another friend, may have had Agassiz at least partly in mind when he observed that there are three stages in scientific discovery. First, people deny that it is true, then they deny that it is important, finally they credit the wrong person. At all events, Agassiz made the field his own. In his quest to understand the dynamics of glaciation, he went everywhere, deep into dangerous crevasses and up to the summits of the craggiest alpine peaks, often apparently unaware that he and his team were the first to climb them. Nearly everywhere, Agassiz encountered an unyielding reluctance to accept his theories. Humboldt urged him to return to his area of real expertise, fossil fish, and give up this mad obsession with ice. But Agassiz was a man possessed by an idea. Agassiz's theory found even less support in Britain, where most naturalists had never seen a glacier and often couldn't grasp the crushing forces that ice in bulk exerts. "Could scratches and polish just be due to ice?" asked Roderick Murchison in a mocking tone at one meeting, evidently imagining the rocks as covered in a kind of light and glassy rime. To his dying day he expressed the frankest incredulity at those ice-mad geologists who believed that glaciers could account for so much. William Hopkins, a Cambridge professor and leading member of the Geological Society, endorsed this view, arguing that the notion that ice could transport boulders presented such obvious mechanical absurdities as to make it unworthy of the Society's attention. Undaunted, Agassiz travelled tirelessly to promote his theory. In 1840, he read a paper to a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science in Glasgow, at which he was openly criticised by the great Charles Lyell. The following year, the Geological Society of Edinburgh passed a resolution conceding that there might be some general merit in the theory, but that certainly none of it applied to Scotland. Lyell did eventually come round. His moment of epiphany came when he realised that a moraine, or line of rocks, near his family estate in Scotland, which he had passed hundreds of times, could only be understood if one accepted that a glacier had dropped them there. But having become converted, Lyell then lost his nerve and backed off from public support of the Ice Age idea. It was a frustrating time for Agassiz. His marriage was breaking up. Schimper was hotly accusing him of the theft of his ideas, Charpentier wouldn't speak to him, and the greatest living geologist offered support of only the most tepid and vacillating kind. In 1846, Agassiz travelled to America to give a series of lectures, and there at last found the esteem he craved. Harvard gave him a professorship and built him a first-rate museum, the Museum of Comparative Zoology. Doubtless it helped that he had settled in New England, where the long winters encouraged a certain sympathy for the idea of interminable periods of cold. It also helped that 6 years after his arrival, the first scientific expedition to Greenland reported that nearly the whole of that semi-continent was covered in an ice sheet, just like the ancient one imagined in Agassiz's theory. At long last, his ideas began to find a real following. The one central defect of Agassiz's theory was that his ice ages had no cause, but assistance was about to come from an unlikely quarter. In the 1860s, journals and other learned publications in Britain began to receive papers on hydrostatics, electricity, and other scientific subjects from a James Croll of Anderson's University in Glasgow. One of the papers on how variations in Earth's orbit might have precipitated ice ages was published in the Philosophical Magazine in 1864 and was recognised at once as a work of the highest standard. So there was some surprise, and perhaps a touch of embarrassment, when it turned out that Croll was not an academic at the university, but a janitor. Born in 1821, Croll grew up poor, and his formal education lasted only to the age of 13. He worked at a variety of jobs, as a carpenter, insurance salesman, keeper of a temperance hotel, before taking a position as a janitor at Anderson's, now the University of Strathclyde, in Glasgow. By somehow inducing his brother to do much of his work, he was able to pass many quiet evenings in the university library, teaching himself physics, mechanics, astronomy, hydrostatics, and the other fashionable sciences of the day, and gradually began to produce a string of papers with a particular emphasis on the motions of Earth and their effect on climate. Kroll was the first to suggest that cyclical changes in the shape of Earth's orbit, from elliptical, which is to say slightly oval, to nearly circular, to elliptical again, might explain the onset and retreat of ice ages. No one had ever thought before to consider an astronomical explanation for variations in Earth's weather. Thanks almost entirely to Kroll's persuasive theory, people in Britain began to become more responsive to the notion that at some former time parts of the Earth had been in the grip of ice. When his ingenuity and aptitude were recognised, Kroll was given a job at the Geological Survey of Scotland, and widely honoured. He was made a Fellow of the Royal Society in London, and of the New York Academy of Science, and given an honorary degree from the University of St. Andrews, among much else. Unfortunately, just as Agassiz's theory was at last beginning to find converts in Europe, he was busy taking it into ever more exotic territory in America. He began to find evidence for glaciers practically everywhere he looked, including near the equator. Eventually he became convinced that ice had once covered the whole Earth, extinguishing all life, which God had then recreated. None of the evidence Agassiz cited supported such a view. Nonetheless, in his adopted country his stature grew and grew, until he was regarded as only slightly below a deity. When he died in 1873, Harvard felt it necessary to appoint 3 professors to take his place. Yet, as sometimes happens, his theories fell swiftly out of fashion. Less than a decade after his death, his successor in the chair of geology at Harvard wrote that the so-called glacial epoch, so popular a few years ago among glacial geologists, may now be rejected without hesitation. Part of the problem was that Kroll's computations suggested that the most recent ice age occurred 80,000 years ago, whereas the geological evidence increasingly indicated that Earth had undergone some sort of dramatic perturbation much more recently than that. Without a plausible explanation for what might have provoked an ice age, the whole theory fell into abeyance. There it might have remained for some time, except that in the early 1900s, a Serbian academic named Milutin Milankovic, who had no background in celestial motions at all, he was a mechanical engineer by training, developed an unexpected interest in the matter. Milankovic realized that the problem with Kroll's theory was not that it was incorrect, but that it was too simple. As Earth moves through space, it is subject not just to variations in the length and shape of its orbit, but also to rhythmic shifts in its angle of orientation to the sun, its tilt and pitch and wobble, all affecting the length and intensity of sunlight falling on any patch of land. In particular, it is subject to 3 changes in position, known formally as its obliquity, precession, and eccentricity, over long periods of time. Milankovic wondered if there might be a relationship between these complex cycles and the comings and goings of ice ages. The difficulty was that the cycles were of widely different lengths, of approximately 20,000, 40,000, and 100,000 years, but varying in each case by up to a few thousand years, which meant that determining their points of intersection over long spans of time involved a nearly endless amount of devoted computation. Essentially, Milankovic had to work out the angle and duration of incoming solar radiation at every latitude on Earth in every season for 1,000,000 years, adjusted for 3 ever-changing variables. Happily, this was precisely the sort of repetitive toil that suited Milankovic's temperament. For the next 20 years, even while on vacation, he worked ceaselessly with pencil and slide rule, computing the tables of his cycles. Work that now could be completed in a day or two with a computer. The calculations all had to be made in his spare time, but in 1914 Milankovic suddenly got a great deal of that when World War I broke out, and he was arrested, owing to his position as a reservist in the Serbian army. He spent most of the next 4 years under loose house arrest in Budapest, required only to report to the police once a week. The rest of his time was spent working in the library of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. He was possibly the happiest prisoner of war in history. The eventual outcome of his diligent scribblings was the 1930 book mathematical climatology and the astronomical theory of climatic changes. Milankovitch was right that there was a relationship between ice ages and planetary wobble, though like most people he assumed that it was a gradual increase in harsh winters that led to these long spells of coldness. It was a Russian-German meteorologist, Vladimir Kuppen, father-in-law of our tectonic friend Alfred Wegener, who saw that the process was more subtle and rather more unnerving than that. The cause of ice ages, Kuppen decided, is to be found in cool summers, not brutal winters. If summers are too cool to melt all the snow that falls on a given area, more incoming sunlight is bounced back by the reflective surface, exacerbating the cooling effect and encouraging yet more snow to fall. The consequence would tend to be self-perpetuating. As snow accumulated into an ice sheet, the region would grow cooler, prompting more ice to accumulate. As the glaciologist Gwen Schultz has noted, it is not necessarily the amount of snow that causes ice sheets, but the fact that snow, however little, lasts. It is thought that an ice age could start from a single unseasonal summer. The leftover snow reflects heat and exacerbates the chilling effect. The process is self-enlarging, unstoppable, and once the ice is really growing, it moves, says McPhee. You have advancing glaciers and an ice age. In the 1950s, because of imperfect dating technology, scientists were unable to correlate Milankovitch's carefully worked-out cycles with the supposed dates of ice ages as then perceived, and so Milankovitch and his calculations increasingly fell out of favour. He died in 1958, unable to prove that his cycles were correct. By this time, write John and Mary Gribben, you would have been hard-pressed to find a geologist or meteorologist who regarded the model as being anything more than an historical curiosity. Not until the 1970s, and the refinement of a potassium-argon method for dating ancient seafloor sediments, were his theories finally vindicated. The Milankovitch cycles alone are not enough to explain cycles of ice ages. Many other factors are involved, not least the disposition of the continents, in particular the presence of land masses over the poles, but the specifics of these are imperfectly understood. It has been suggested, however, that if you hauled North America, Eurasia, and Greenland just 300 miles north, we would have permanent and inescapable ice ages. We are very lucky, it appears, to get any good weather at all. Even less well understood are the cycles of comparative balminess within ice ages, known as interglacials. It is mildly unnerving to reflect that the whole of meaningful human history, the development of farming, the creation of towns, the rise of mathematics and writing and science and all the rest, has taken place within an atypical patch of fair weather. Previous interglacials have lasted as little as 8,000 years. Our own has already passed its 10,000th anniversary. The fact is, we are still very much in an ice age. It's just a somewhat shrunken one, though less shrunken than many people realize. At the height of the last period of glaciation, around 20,000 years ago, about 30% of the Earth's land surface was under ice. 10% still is, and a further 14% is in a state of permafrost. Three-quarters of all the fresh water on Earth is locked up in ice even now, and we have ice caps at both poles. A situation that may be unique in Earth's history. That there are snowy winters through much of the world, and permanent glaciers even in temperate places such as New Zealand, may seem quite natural, but in fact it is a most unusual situation for the planet. For most of its history, until fairly recent times, the general pattern for Earth was to be hot, with no permanent ice anywhere. The current ice age, ice epoch, really, started about 40 million years ago, and has ranged from murderously bad to not bad at all. Ice ages tend to wipe out evidence of earlier ice ages, so the further back you go, the more sketchy the picture grows. But it appears that we have had at least 17 severe glacial episodes in the last 2.5 million years or so, the period that coincides with the rise of Homo erectus in Africa, followed by modern humans. Two commonly cited culprits for the present epoch are the rise of the Himalayas and the formation of the Isthmus of Panama, the first disrupting air flows, the second ocean currents. India, once an island, has pushed 2,000 kilometres into the Asian landmass over the last 45 million years, raising not only the Himalayas, but also the vast Tibetan plateau behind them. The hypothesis is that the higher landscape was not only cooler, but diverted winds in a way that made them flow north and toward North America, making it more susceptible to long-term chills. Then, beginning about 5 million years ago, Panama rose from the sea, closing the gap between North and South America, disrupting the flows of warming currents between the Pacific and Atlantic, and changing patterns of precipitation across at least half the world. One consequence was a drying out of Africa, which caused apes to climb down out of trees and go looking for a new way of living on the emerging savannas. At all events, with the oceans and continents arranged as they are now, it appears that ice will be a long-term part of our future. According to John McPhee, about 50 more glacial episodes can be expected, each lasting 100,000 years or so, before we can hope for a really long thaw. Before 50 million years ago, Earth had no regular ice ages. But when we did have them, they tended to be colossal. A massive freezing occurred about 2.2 billion years ago, followed by a billion years or so of warmth. Then there was another ice age, even larger than the first, so large that some scientists are now referring to the age in which it occurred as the Cryogenian, or Super Ice Age. The condition is more popularly known as Snowball Earth. Snowball, however, barely captures the murderousness of conditions. The theory is that because of a fall in solar radiation of about 6% and a drop-off in the production or retention of greenhouse gases, Earth essentially lost its ability to hold on to its heat. It became a kind of all-over Antarctica. Temperatures plunged by as much as 80 degrees Fahrenheit. The entire surface of the planet may have frozen solid, with ocean ice up to half a mile thick at higher latitudes and tens of yards thick even in the tropics. There is a serious problem in all this in that the geological evidence indicates ice everywhere, including around the equator, while the biological evidence suggests just as firmly that there must have been open water somewhere. For one thing, cyanobacteria survived the experience, and they photosynthesize. For that, they needed sunlight. But as you will know if you have ever tried to peer through it, ice quickly becomes opaque, and after only a few yards would pass on no light at all. Two possibilities have been suggested. One is that a little ocean water did remain exposed, perhaps because of some kind of localized warming at a hot spot. The other is that maybe the ice formed in such a way that it remained translucent, a condition that does sometimes happen in nature. If Earth did freeze over, then there is the very difficult question of how it ever got warm again. An icy planet should reflect so much heat that it would stay frozen forever. It appears that rescue may have come from our molten interior. Once again, we may be indebted to tectonics for allowing us to be here. The idea is that we were saved by volcanoes, which pushed through the buried surface, pumping out lots of heat and gases that melted the snows and reformed the atmosphere. Interestingly, the end of this hyper-frigid episode is marked by the Cambrian outburst, the springtime event of life's history. In fact, it may not have been as tranquil as all that. As Earth warmed, it probably had the wildest weather it has ever experienced, with hurricanes powerful enough to raise waves to the heights of skyscrapers, and rainfalls of indescribable intensity. Throughout all this, the tube worms and clams and other life forms adhering to deep ocean vents undoubtedly went on as if nothing were amiss. But all other life on Earth probably came as close as it ever has to checking out entirely. It was all a long time ago, and at this stage we just don't know. Compared with a Cryogenian outburst, the ice ages of more recent times seem pretty small scale, but of course they were immensely grand by the standards of anything to be found on Earth today. The Wisconsin ice sheet, which covered much of Europe and North America, was 2 miles thick in places, and marched forward at a rate of about 400 feet a year. What a thing it must have been to behold! Even at their leading edge, the ice sheets could be nearly half a mile thick. Imagine standing at the base of a wall of ice 2,000 feet high. Behind this edge, over an area measuring in the millions of square miles, would be nothing but more ice. with only a few of the tallest mountain summits poking through. Whole continents sagged under the weight of so much ice, and even now, 12,000 years after the glacier's withdrawal, are still rising back into place. The ice sheets didn't just dribble out boulders and long lines of gravelly moraines, but dumped entire land masses, Long Island and Cape Cod and Nantucket, among others, as they slowly swept along. It's little wonder that geologists before Agassiz had trouble grasping their monumental capacity to rework landscapes. If ice sheets advanced again, we have nothing in our armory that could deflect them. In 1964, at Prince William Sound in Alaska, one of the largest glacial fields in North America was hit by the strongest earthquake ever recorded on the continent. It measured 9.2 on the Richter scale. Along the fault line, the land rose by as much as 20 feet. The quake was so violent, in fact, that it made water slosh out of pools in Texas. And what effect did this unparalleled outburst have on the glaciers of Prince William Sound? None at all. They just soaked it up and kept on moving. For a long time it was thought that we moved into and out of ice ages gradually, over hundreds of thousands of years, but we now know that that has not been the case. Thanks to ice cores from Greenland, we have a detailed record of climate for something over 100,000 years, and what is found there is not comforting. It shows that for most of its recent history, Earth has been nothing like the stable and tranquil place that civilization has known, but rather has lurched violently between periods of warmth and brutal chill. Toward the end of the last big glaciation, some 12,000 years ago, Earth began to warm, and quite rapidly, but then abruptly plunged back into bitter cold for 1,000 years or so in an event known to science as the Younger Dryas. The name comes from the Arctic plant, the Dryas, which is one of the first to recolonize land after an ice sheet withdraws. There was also an older Dryas period, but it wasn't so sharp. At the end of this 1,000-year onslaught, average temperatures leapt again by as much as 7 degrees in 20 years, which doesn't sound terribly dramatic, but is equivalent to exchanging the climate of Scandinavia for that of the Mediterranean in just 2 decades. Locally, changes have been even more dramatic. Greenland ice cores show the temperatures there changing by as much as 15 degrees in 10 years, drastically altering rainfall patterns and growing conditions. This must have been unsettling enough on a thinly populated planet. Today the consequences would be pretty well unimaginable. What is most alarming is that we have no idea, none, what natural phenomena could so swiftly rattle Earth's thermometer. As Elizabeth Colbert, writing in The New Yorker, has observed, "No known external force, or even any that has been hypothesized, seems capable of yanking the temperature back and forth as violently and as often as these cores have shown to be the case. There seems to be," she adds, "some vast and terrible feedback loop, probably involving the oceans and disruptions of the normal patterns of ocean circulation, but all this is a long way from being understood." One theory is that the heavy inflow of meltwater to the seas at the beginning of the Younger Dryas reduced the saltiness and thus density of northern oceans, causing the Gulf Stream to swerve to the south like a driver trying to avoid a collision. Deprived of the Gulf Stream's warmth, the northern latitudes return to chilly conditions. But this doesn't begin to explain why 1,000 years later, when the Earth warmed once again, the Gulf Stream didn't veer as before. Instead, we were given the period of unusual tranquillity known as the Holocene, the time in which we live now. There is no reason to suppose that this stretch of climatic stability should last much longer. In fact, some authorities believe that we are in for even worse than what went before. It is natural to suppose that global warming would act as a useful counterweight to the Earth's tendency to plunge back into glacial conditions. However, as Colbert has pointed out, when you are confronted with a fluctuating and unpredictable climate, the last thing you'd want to do is conduct a vast unsupervised experiment on it. It has even been suggested, with more plausibility than would at first seem evident, that an ice age might actually be induced by a rise in temperatures. The idea is that a slight warming would enhance evaporation rates and increase cloud cover, leading in the higher latitudes to more persistent accumulations of snow. In fact, global warming could plausibly, if paradoxically, lead to powerful localized cooling in North America and Northern Europe. Climate is the product of so many variables: rising and falling carbon dioxide levels, the shifts of continents, solar activity, the stately wobbles of the Milankovitch cycles, that it is as difficult to comprehend the events of the past as it is to predict those of the future. Much is simply beyond us. Take Antarctica. For at least 20 million years after it settled over the South Pole, Antarctica remained covered in plants and free of ice. That simply shouldn't have been possible. No less intriguing are the known ranges of some late dinosaurs. The British geologist Stephen Drury notes that forests within 10 degrees latitude of the North Pole were home to great beasts, including Tyrannosaurus rex. "That is bizarre," he writes, "for such a high latitude is continually dark for 3 months of the year. Moreover, there is no evidence that these high latitudes suffered severe winters. Oxygen isotope studies suggest that the climate around Fairbanks, Alaska, was about the same in the late Cretaceous period as it is now. So what was Tyrannosaurus doing there? Either it migrated seasonally over enormous distances, or it spent much of the year in snowdrifts in the dark." In Australia, which at that time was more polar in its orientation, a retreat to warmer climes wasn't possible. How dinosaurs managed to survive in such conditions can only be guessed. One thought to bear in mind is that if the ice sheets did start to form again, for whatever reason, there is a lot more water for them to draw on this time. The Great Lakes, Hudson Bay, the countless lakes of Canada, these weren't there to fuel the last ice age. They were created by it. On the other hand, the next phase of our history could see us melting a lot of ice rather than making it. If all the ice sheets melted, sea levels would rise by 200 feet, the height of a 20-story building, and every coastal city in the world would be inundated. More likely, at least in the short term, is the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. In the past 50 years, the waters around it have warmed by 2.5 degrees centigrade, and collapses have increased dramatically. Because of the underlying geology of the area, a large-scale collapse is all the more possible. If so, sea levels globally would rise, and pretty quickly, by between 15 and 20 feet on average. The extraordinary fact is that we don't know which is more likely: a future offering us eons of perishing frigidity, or one giving us equal expanses of steamy heat. Only one thing is certain: we live on a knife edge. In the long run, incidentally, ice ages are by no means bad news for the planet. They grind up rocks and leave behind new soils of sumptuous richness, and gouge out freshwater lakes that provide abundant nutritive possibilities for hundreds of species of being. They act as a spur to migration and keep the planet dynamic. As Tim Flannery has remarked, there is only one question you need ask of a continent in order to determine the fate of its people: did you have a good ice age? And with that in mind, it's time to look at a species of ape that truly did. 28. The Mysterious Biped. Just before Christmas, 1887, a young Dutch doctor with an un-Dutch name, Marie-Eugène François Thomas Dubois, arrived in Sumatra, in the Dutch East Indies, with the intention of finding the earliest human remains on Earth. Though Dutch, Dubois was from Eijden, a town bordering the French-speaking part of Belgium. Several things were extraordinary about this. To begin with, no one had ever gone looking for ancient human bones before. Everything that had been found to this point had been found accidentally, and nothing in Dubois' background suggested that he was the ideal candidate to make the process intentional. He was an anatomist by training, with no background in paleontology. Nor was there any special reason to suppose that the East Indies would hold early human remains. Logic dictated that if ancient people were to be found at all, it would be on a large and long populated landmass, not in the comparative fastness of an archipelago. Dubois was driven to the East Indies on nothing stronger than a hunch, the availability of employment, and the knowledge that Sumatra was full of caves, the environment in which most of the important hominid fossils had so far been found. What is most extraordinary in all this, nearly miraculous really, is that he found what he was looking for. At the time Dubois conceived his plan to search for a missing link, the human fossil record consisted of very little. 5 incomplete Neanderthal skeletons, 1 partial jawbone of uncertain provenance, and 6 Ice Age humans recently found by railway workers in a cave at a cliff called Cro-Magnon, near Les Aisies, France. Of the Neanderthal specimens, the best preserved was sitting unremarked on a shelf in London. It had been found by workers blasting rock from a quarry in Gibraltar in 1848, so its preservation was a wonder. But unfortunately no one yet appreciated what it was. After being briefly described at a meeting of the Gibraltar Scientific Society, it had been sent to the Hunterian Museum in London, where it remained undisturbed, but for an occasional light dusting, for over 50 years. The first formal description of it wasn't written until 1907, and then by a geologist named William Solas, with only a passing competency in anatomy. So instead the name and credit for the discovery of the first early humans went to the Neander Valley in Germany, not unfittingly, as it happens, for by uncanny coincidence Neander in Greek means new man. There in 1856 workmen at another quarry in a cliff face overlooking the Dussel River found some curious-looking bones, which they passed to a local schoolteacher, knowing he had an interest in all things natural. To his great credit, the teacher, Johann Karl Fuhlrott, saw that he had some new type of human, that quite what it was, and how special, would be matters of dispute for some time. Many people refused to accept that the Neanderthal bones were ancient at all. August Meyer, a professor at the University of Bonn, and a man of influence, insisted that the bones were merely those of a Mongolian Cossack soldier who had been wounded while fighting in Germany in 1814 and had crawled into the cave to die. Hearing of this, T.H. Huxley in England dryly observed how remarkable it was that the soldier, though mortally wounded, had climbed 60 feet up a cliff, divested himself of his clothing and personal effects, sealed the cave opening, and buried himself under 2 feet of soil. Another anthropologist, puzzling over the Neanderthal's heavy brow ridge, suggested that it was the result of long-term frowning, arising from a poorly healed forearm fracture. In their eagerness to reject the idea of earlier humans, authorities were often willing to embrace the most singular possibilities. At about the time that Dubois was setting out for Sumatra, a skeleton found in Périgueux was confidently declared to be that of an Eskimo. Quite what an ancient Eskimo was doing in southwest France was never comfortably explained. It was actually an early Cro-Magnon. It was against this background that Dubois began his search for ancient human bones. He did no digging himself, but instead used 50 convicts lent by the Dutch authorities. For a year they worked on Sumatra, then transferred to Java, and there in 1891 Dubois, or rather his team, for Dubois himself seldom visited the sites, found a section of ancient human cranium, now known as the Trinil skull cap. Though only part of a skull, it showed that the owner had had distinctly non-human features, but a much larger brain than any ape. Dubois called it Anthropithecus erectus, later changed for technical reasons to Pithecanthropus erectus, and declared it the missing link between apes and humans. It quickly became popularized as Java Man. Today we know it as Homo erectus. The next year, Dubois' workers found a virtually complete thigh bone that looked surprisingly modern. In fact, many anthropologists think it is modern and has nothing to do with Java Man. If it is an erectus bone, it is unlike any other found since. Nonetheless, Dubois used the thigh bone to deduce, correctly as it turned out, that Pithecanthropus walked upright. He also produced, with nothing but a scrap of cranium and one tooth, a model of the complete skull, which also proved uncannily accurate. In 1895, Dubois returned to Europe expecting a triumphal reception. In fact, he met nearly the opposite reaction. Most scientists disliked both his conclusions and the arrogant manner in which he presented them. The skull cap, they said, was that of an ape, probably a gibbon, and not of any early human. Hoping to bolster his case, in 1897, Dubois allowed a respected anatomist from the University of Strasbourg, Gustav Schwalbe, to make a cast of the skull cap. To Dubois' dismay, Schwalbe thereupon produced a monograph that received far more sympathetic attention than anything Dubois had written, and followed with a lecture tour in which he was celebrated nearly as warmly as if he had dug up the skull himself. Appalled and embittered, Dubois withdrew into an undistinguished position as a professor of geology at the University of Amsterdam, and for the next 2 decades refused to let anyone examine his precious fossils again. He died in 1940, an unhappy man. Meanwhile, and half a world away, in late 1924, Raymond Dart, the Australian-born head of anatomy at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was sent a small but remarkably complete skull of a child, with an intact face, a lower jaw, and what is known as an endocast, a natural cast of the brain, from a limestone quarry on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, at a dusty spot called Taung. Dart could see at once that the Taung skull was not of a Homo erectus, like Dubois' Java man, but from an earlier, more ape-like creature. He placed its age at 2 million years and dubbed it Australopithecus africanus, or Southern Ape Man of Africa. In a report to Nature, Dart called the Taung remains amazingly human, and suggested the need for an entirely new family, Homo simiadi, the man-apes, to accommodate the find. The authorities were even less favourably disposed to Dart than they had been to Dubois. Nearly everything about his theory, indeed nearly everything about Dart, it appears, annoyed them. First, he had proved himself lamentably presumptuous by conducting the analysis himself, rather than calling on the help of more worldly experts in Europe. Even his chosen name, Australopithecus, showed a lack of scholarly application, combining as it did Greek and Latin roots. Above all, his conclusions flew in the face of accepted wisdom. Humans and apes, it was agreed, had split apart at least 15 million years ago in Asia. If humans had arisen in Africa, why, that would make us negroid, for goodness sake. It was rather as if someone working today were to announce that he had found the ancestral bones of humans in, say, Missouri. It just didn't fit with what was known. Dart's sole supporter of note was Robert Broome, a Scottish-born physician and paleontologist of considerable intellect and cherishably eccentric nature. It was Broome's habit, for instance, to do his field work naked when the weather was warm, which was often. He was also known for conducting dubious anatomical experiments on his poorer and more tractable patients. When the patients died, which was also often, he would sometimes bury their bodies in his back garden to dig up for study later. Broome was an accomplished paleontologist, and since he was also resident in South Africa, he was able to examine the Taung skull at first hand. He could see at once that it was as important as Dart supposed, and spoke out vigorously on Dart's behalf, but to no effect. For the next 50 years the received wisdom was that the Taung child was an ape and nothing more. Most textbooks didn't even mention it. Dart spent 5 years working up a monograph, but could find no one to publish it. Eventually he gave up the quest to publish altogether, though he did continue hunting for fossils. For years, the skull, today recognized as one of the supreme treasures of anthropology, sat as a paperweight on a colleague's desk. At the time Dart made his announcement in 1924, only 4 categories of ancient hominid were known: Homo heidelbergensis, Homo rhodesiensis, Neanderthals, and Dubois' Java man. But all that was about to change in a very big way. First, in China, a gifted Canadian amateur named Davidson Black began to poke around at a place, Dragon Bone Hill, that was locally famous as a hunting ground for old bones. Unfortunately, rather than preserving the bones for study, the Chinese ground them up to make medicines. We can only guess how many priceless Homo erectus bones ended up as a sort of Chinese equivalent of bicarbonate of soda. The site had been much denuded by the time Black arrived, but he found a single fossilized molar, and on the basis of that alone, quite brilliantly announced the discovery of Sinanthropus pekinensis, which quickly became known as Peking Man. At Black's urging, more determined excavations were undertaken, and many other bones found. Unfortunately, all were lost the day after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, when a contingent of U.S. Marines trying to spirit the bones and themselves out of the country was intercepted by the Japanese and imprisoned. Seeing that their crates held nothing but bones, the Japanese soldiers left them at the roadside. It was the last that was ever seen of them. In the meantime, back on Dubois' old turf of Java, a team led by Ralph von Königswald had found another group of early humans, which became known as the Solo people, from the site of their discovery on the Solo River at Nandong. Königswald's discoveries might have been more impressive still, but for a tactical error that was realized too late. He had offered locals 10 cents for every piece of hominid bone they could come up with, then discovered, to his horror, that they had been enthusiastically smashing large pieces into small ones to maximize their income. Some continue to observe the two hominid genera suggested by Howell in 1960, but others place some of the Australopithecines in a separate genus called Paranthropus, and still others add an earlier group called Ardipithecus. Some put Pragans into Australopithecus, and some into a new classification, Homo antiquus. But most don't recognize Pragans as a separate species at all. There is no central authority that rules on these things. The only way a name becomes accepted is by consensus, and there is often very little of that. A big part of the problem, paradoxically, is a shortage of evidence. Since the dawn of time, several billion human or human-like beings have lived, each contributing a little genetic variability to the total human stock. Out of this vast number, the whole of our understanding of human prehistory is based on the remains, often exceedingly fragmentary, of perhaps 5,000 individuals. You could fit it all into the back of a pickup truck, if you didn't mind how much you jumbled everything up. Ian Tattersall, the bearded and friendly curator of anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, replied when I asked him the size of the total world archive of hominid and early human bones. The shortage wouldn't be so bad if the bones were distributed evenly through time and space, but of course they're not. They appear randomly, often in the most tantalizing fashion. Homo erectus walked the earth for well over 1 million years and inhabited territory from the Atlantic edge of Europe to the Pacific side of China. Yet if you brought back to life every Homo erectus individual whose existence we can vouch for, they wouldn't fill a school bus. Homo habilis consists of even less, just 2 partial skeletons and a number of isolated limb bones. Something as short-lived as our own civilization would almost certainly not be known from the fossil record at all. In Europe, Tattersall offers by way of illustration, you've got hominid skulls in Georgia dated to about 1.7 million years ago, but then you have a gap of almost 1 million years before the next remains turn up in Spain, right on the other side of the continent. And then you've got another 300,000-year gap before you get a Homo heidelbergensis in Germany, and none of them looks terribly much like any of the others. He smiled. It's from these kinds of fragmentary pieces that you're trying to work out the history of entire species. It's quite a tall order. We really have very little idea of the relationships between many ancient species, which led to us and which were evolutionary dead ends. Some probably don't deserve to be regarded as separate species at all. It is the patchiness of the record that makes each new find look so sudden and distinct from all the others. If we had tens of thousands of skeletons distributed at regular intervals through the historical record, there would be appreciably more degrees of shading. Whole new species don't emerge instantaneously, as the fossil record implies, but gradually out of other existing species. The closer you go back to a point of divergence, the closer the similarities are, so that it becomes exceedingly difficult and sometimes impossible to distinguish a late Homo erectus from an early Homo sapiens, since it is likely to be both and neither. Similar disagreements can often arise over questions of identification from fragmentary remains. Deciding, for instance, whether a particular bone represents a female Australopithecus boisei or a male Homo habilis. With so little to be certain about, scientists often have to make assumptions based on other objects found nearby, and these may be little more than valiant guesses. As Alan Walker and Pat Shipman have dryly observed, If you correlate tool discovery with the species of creature most often found nearby, you would have to conclude that early hand tools were mostly made by antelopes. Perhaps nothing better typifies the confusion than the fragmentary bundle of contradictions that was Homo habilis. Simply put, habilis bones make no sense. When arranged in sequence, they show males and females evolving at different rates and in different directions, the males becoming less ape-like and more human with time, while females from the same period appear to be moving away from humanness toward greater apeness. Some authorities don't believe habilis is a valid category at all. Tattersall and his colleague Jeffrey Schwartz dismiss it as a mere wastebasket species, one into which unrelated fossils could be conveniently swept. Even those who see habilis as an independent species don't agree on whether it is of the same genus as us or is from a side branch that never came to anything. Finally, but perhaps above all, human nature is a factor in all this. Scientists have a natural tendency to interpret finds in the way that most flatters their stature. It is a rare paleontologist indeed who announces that he has found a cache of bones, but that they are nothing to get excited about. Or as John Reader understandably observes in the book Missing Links, it is remarkable how often the first interpretations of new evidence have confirmed the preconceptions of its discoverer. All this leaves ample room for arguments, of course, and nobody likes to argue more than paleoanthropologists. And of all the disciplines in science, paleoanthropology boasts perhaps the largest share of egos, say the authors of the recent Java Man, a book, it may be noted, that itself devotes long, wonderfully unself-conscious passages to attacks on the inadequacies of others, in particular the author's former close colleague, Donald Johansson. Here is a small sampling. In our years of collaboration at the Institute, he, Johansson, developed a well-deserved, if unfortunate, reputation for unpredictable and high-decibel personal verbal assaults, sometimes accompanied by the tossing around of books or whatever else came conveniently to hand. So, bearing in mind that there is little you can say about human prehistory that won't be disputed by someone somewhere, other than that we most certainly had one, what we think we know about who we are and where we come from is roughly this. For the first 99.99999% of our history as organisms, we were in the same ancestral line as chimpanzees. Virtually nothing is known about the prehistory of chimpanzees, but whatever they were, we were. Then, about 7 million years ago, something major happened. A group of new beings emerged from the tropical forests of Africa and began to move about on the open savanna. These were the Australopithecines, and for the next 5 million years they would be the world's dominant hominid species. Austral is from the Latin for southern, and has no connection in this context to Australia. Australopithecines came in several varieties, some slender and gracile, like Raymond Dart's town child, others more sturdy and robust, but all were capable of walking upright. Some of these species existed for well over 1 million years, others for a more modest few 100,000. But it is worth bearing in mind that even the least successful had histories many times longer than we have yet achieved. The most famous hominid remains in the world are those of a 3.18 million-year-old Australopithecine found at Heydar in Ethiopia in 1974 by a team led by Donald Johansson. Formerly known as AL, for a far locality, 288-1, the skeleton became more familiarly known as Lucy, after the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Johansson has never doubted her importance. "She is our earliest ancestor, the missing link between ape and human," he has said. Lucy was tiny, just 3.5 feet tall. She could walk, though how well is a matter of some dispute. She was evidently a good climber, too. Much else is unknown. Her skull was almost entirely missing, so little could be said with confidence about her brain size, though skull fragments suggested it was small. Most books describe Lucy's skeleton as being 40% complete, though some put it closer to half, and one, produced by the American Museum of Natural History, describes Lucy as 2/3 complete. The BBC television series Ape Man actually called it a complete skeleton, even while showing that it was anything but. A human body has 206 bones, but many of these are repeated. If you have the left femur from a specimen, you don't need the right to know its dimensions. Strip out all the redundant bones, and the total you're left with is 120, what is called a half skeleton. Even by this fairly accommodating standard, and even counting the slightest fragment as a full bone, Lucy constituted only 28% of a half skeleton, and only about 20% of a full one. In The Wisdom of the Bones, Alan Walker recounts how he once asked Johansson how he had come up with a figure of 40%. Johansson breezily replied that he had discounted the 106 bones of the hands and feet, more than half the body's total, and a fairly important half too, one would have thought, since Lucy's principal defining attribute was the use of those hands and feet to deal with a changing world. At all events, rather less is known about Lucy than is generally supposed. It isn't even actually known that she was a female. Her sex is merely presumed from her diminutive size. 2 years after Lucy's discovery, at Laetoli in Tanzania, Mary Leakey found footprints left by two individuals from, it is thought, the same family of hominids. The prints had been made when two Australopithecines had walked through muddy ash following a volcanic eruption. The ash had later hardened, preserving the impressions of their feet for a distance of over 23 meters. The American Museum of Natural History in New York has an absorbing diorama that records the moment of their passing. It depicts life-sized recreations of a male and a female walking side by side across the ancient African plain. They are hairy and chimp-like in dimensions, but have a bearing and gait that suggests humanness. The most striking feature of the display is that the male holds his left arm protectively around the female's shoulder. It is a tender and affecting gesture, suggestive of close bonding. The tableau is done with such conviction that it is easy to overlook the consideration that virtually everything above the footprints is imaginary. Almost every external aspect of the two figures, degree of hairiness, facial appendages, whether they had human noses or chimp noses, expressions, skin colour, size and shape of the female's breasts, is necessarily suppositional. We can't even say that they were a couple. The female figure may in fact have been a child. Nor can we be certain that they were Australopithecines. They are assumed to be Australopithecines because there are no other known candidates. I had been told that they were posed like that because, during the building of the diorama, the female figure kept toppling over. But Ian Tattersall insists with a laugh that the story is untrue. Obviously we don't know whether the male had his arm around the female or not, but we do know from the stride measurements that they were walking side by side and close together, close enough to be touching. It was quite an exposed area, so they were probably feeling vulnerable. That's why we tried to give them slightly worried expressions. I asked him if he was troubled about the amount of license that was taken in reconstructing the figures. "It's always a problem in making recreations," he agreed, readily enough. "You wouldn't believe how much discussion can go into deciding details like whether Neanderthals had eyebrows or not. It was just the same for the Laetoli figures. We simply can't know the details of what they looked like, but we can convey their size and posture, and make some reasonable assumptions about their probable appearance. If I had to do it again, I think I might have made them just slightly more ape-like and less human. These creatures weren't humans. They were bipedal apes." Until very recently it was assumed that we were descended from Lucy and the Laetoli creatures, but now many authorities aren't so sure. Although certain physical features, the teeth for instance, suggest a possible link between us, other parts of the Australopithecine anatomy are more troubling. In their book, Extinct Humans, Tattersall and Schwartz point out that the upper portion of the human femur is very like that of the apes, but not of the Australopithecines. So if Lucy is in a direct line between apes and modern humans, it means we must have adopted an Australopithecine femur for 1 million years or so, then gone back to an ape femur when we moved on to the next phase of our development. They believe, in fact, that not only was Lucy not our ancestor, she wasn't even much of a walker. "Lucy and her kind did not locomote in anything like the modern human fashion," insists Tattersall. "Only when these hominids had to travel between arboreal habitats would they find themselves walking bipedally, forced to do so by their own anatomies." Johansson doesn't accept this. Lucy's hips and the muscular arrangement of her pelvis, he has written, would have made it as hard for her to climb trees as it is for modern humans. Matters grew murkier still in 2001 and 2002, when 4 exceptional new specimens were found. One discovered by Meave Leakey of the famous fossil-hunting family at Lake Turkana in Kenya, and called Kenyanthropus platyops, Kenyan flatface, is from about the same time as Lucy, and raises the possibility that it was our ancestor, and Lucy was an unsuccessful side branch. Also found